Hello, and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest. January 5th, 2023, the Kevin McCarthy in Hell edition. I am David Plotz of CityCast in Washington, D.C. I'm joined by John Dickerson of CBS's Prime Time from New York City. Hello, John.
Hello, David.
And by Emily Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine and Yale University Law School from New Haven. Hello, Emily.
Hello. Happy New Year to everybody.
Happy New Year. Happy New Year. I hope you guys had a happy New Year. We haven't even talked about it.
It was happy until we should let listeners know that your New York correspondent is operating on like an hour of sleep over 3 days because he's done something awful to his back. So I must be excused for anything that I say because I cannot stand upright. I want everything excused except for the smart things I say, in which case it's a sign of my innate, inescapable skill.
I don't know whether this punch drunk sleeplessness will make you goofy or just slow. We'll find out.
Ow. Hurts to laugh.
As I said before we came on, you are in less pain than Kevin McCarthy. This week on the Gabfest, the gripping and really depressing spectacle of the House of Representatives being paralyzed by a Republican revolt against would-be House Speaker Kevin McCarthy. Then, how did George Santos get elected to Congress and what should be done about him? And then the Biden administration made it somewhat easier to get the medicines required for medication abortions. Emily will explain what that means, what the significance of that is. Plus, of course, we'll have cocktail chatter.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
As we tape on Thursday morning, the House of Representatives continues to stage a Beckett or a Sartre play, like a Waiting for Godot, but Godot is the House speakership for Kevin McCarthy, or No Exit, but it is not hell that they are stuck in. It is the Capitol building. John, this is amazing. It is, however, totally unsurprising. It is the natural culmination of several decades of increasing Republican nihilism and spectacle seeking. Yes?
Yes, I think the history to which you refer is going back, let's say, to Newt Gingrich, when he was bounced from his role as Speaker. He accused the farthest right members who pushed him out as being, he called them cannibals. John Boehner was ousted by the same group of people, not the same individuals, but the same people exhibiting the same behavior. Paul Ryan was driven from the job by some of the same forces. So the only way this is different in history is that basically now they're trying to get rid of the speaker before the speaker even has the job. So these forces are becoming more efficient at getting rid of speakers who they think are toadying to the Washington establishment.
And is this a revolt over issues, John? Or is it just watching people who don't want order, disrespect anybody who, you know, they see as playing the Washington game? Like, what's the point?
Yes, right you are, Emily. It's both things, I think, actually. I mean, so it was long foretold and obvious this was going to happen to Kevin McCarthy in particular because he played nice with some of the Congressman Paul Gosar, Congresswoman Boebert, and others who are in this wing that's now trying to deny him the job. And so many people, including some who never make predictions about anything, said, if you don't censure these people for their behavior, and in fact encourage it by not censuring them, it's just going to bite you in the rear end later. And that, in fact, is what's happening now. But not every one of the, say, 20 or so who are blocking his elevation to speaker at the moment is doing it for the reasons you suggested. There are some, Chip Roy of Texas is one, who have serious issues and about serious things, like, for example, having an open amendment process to for bills on the floor. That's something we should all want because it forces legislators to legislate. It takes powers away from the speaker. The speaker wants things to be orderly, wants bills to get to the floor that have the priorities of their party in it, and would like, if you're a Republican speaker, would like those things to pass only with Republican votes, because if you need Democratic votes, then the legislation gets watered down. So tight control over the way legislation bounces through the system is something you want. Well, these open amendment process would allow anybody to offer things, and amendments would get onto bills that might be supported by any number of different kinds of coalitions, which would then potentially imperil the final bill. The supporters of open amendment process would say, no, it would make it better because it would mean more voices would have input on the bill. The last round of this, when they were trying to get rid of John Boehner, the same version of the House caucus was saying, you know, we want somebody who's going to take on Mitch McConnell. The Speaker of the House doesn't take on the Majority Leader of the Senate, which was his Majority Leader at the time. It just doesn't, that's not the way the system works. And so the things that they are asking for are possibly wise. It's just the reasons for which they're asking for them is unrealistic in a legislative body where you need 218 votes to pass things.
They cast themselves as rebels, and rebels imbue them with a kind of glamour that they certainly don't deserve when you look at who these people are. I mean, the idea that Matt Gaetz or Lauren Boebert deserves our sympathy or our attention to me is offensive. On the other hand, it is deeply difficult to feel any sympathy for Kevin McCarthy, a man who has been willing to say or do anything to get this job, who has evinced very little interest in legislating for the good of the country and seems to have no plans for what he would do with it except investigate Hunter Biden and impeach the Homeland Security Secretary. So I had a boss used to talk about situations being like the Battle of Stalingrad, where you want both sides to lose. It is a situation where Kevin McCarthy probably is like the least bad speaker available to if you're a House Democrat. On the other hand, he's just doesn't deserve it, right, Emily?
I mean, there is just this spectacle aspect of this and the way in which he has clawed his way to the job. I mean, I was remembering this week that he came into prominence with Paul Ryan and Eric Cantor. They were supposed to be the young guns. They were in some ways like the rebels, or at least the anti-establishment, here's this new way, figures of their era. And now, of course, like Ryan is joined corporate boards in private life or whatever he's doing. And Eric Cantor was drummed out of Congress by his own voters. So McCarthy's kind of left here trying, placating, but they helped unleash these forces, of course, that are now refusing to fall into line. And so, yeah, it is hard to feel sorry for him. I also, what do you think about this idea that, you know, this is a crisis because the House isn't around to respond to an emergency? Like, it seems to me like, didn't we just have a few weeks where the House wasn't around? And like, how, they're not emergency room doctors. I have trouble keep taking this seriously.
There are theatrical aspects of it that are potentially appealing. One is they all have to be there. And one of the things that this restive group of rebels, or whatever you want to call them, are asking for is that they get rid of, and I think McCarthy has already said yes to this, get rid of proxy voting or voting from a distance. You have to be there. And I like that. I like the fact that they're all on the floor and they all are having, now, legislating and the job of being in Congress is not about what you do on the floor necessarily. But for important things, like making sure everybody's around is perfectly fine. But the other thing, as Jake Tapper pointed out, is that since there are no House rules, the C-SPAN cameras, which once the rules are in place, lock the camera in just on who's speaking and don't, because of, you know, they're given their instructions by the majority, those rules aren't in place. And so the C-SPAN cameras are able to show us all the things that are going on, the side conversations and all that, because there are no rules in place, which I think is just a kind of amusing little side aspect of this.
I had a question, which I posed to you guys over text the other day, which I continue to have. So we're taping on Thursday morning. The House will come back into session Thursday at noon. And by the time you listeners listen to this, they may have found a compromise candidate. John Dickerson might be Speaker of the House, for all we know. Anything could have happened in this afternoon session if McCarthy steps away from the field. What I was wondering is why the Democrats don't screw with the system and give McCarthy the votes to be speaker? Why don't they just give him 21 votes and he becomes speaker? But he becomes speaker by dint of their support. It's a kind of troll. I think I wouldn't do it because I guess you have principles and you don't want to just mess with the system just to mess with the system. But I feel like creating a system where Kevin McCarthy is speaker, he only is there because Democrats voted for him, and Republicans haven't resolved their own mess would be a recipe for further damage to the Republican Party.
Democrats have argued since basically Newt Gingrich that the Republican Party is captive of its most ideological forces. And then, of course, that was true with Donald Trump. This is as if you sat down and designed a celebration to enact that worldview. I mean, this is a display of everything Democrats have said about Republicans for a long time. And so I think that is its most maximum utility for Democrats. There have been ideas floated that Democrats would support McCarthy in return for, and this is never going to happen, in return for assurances that the debt ceiling would be lifted to, you know, infinity and a couple of other things, full funding of the government and a couple of other Democratic priorities. But that's less of a trolling and more of an effort to squeeze something out of McCarthy's difficulty.
Yeah, you have to imagine they would really govern. And that doesn't seem to be what the House is planning to do, right? I mean, the Ohio House did something like this, where some Democrats are supporting a more moderate Republican speaker who did not have the support of the more, you know, conservative forces in Ohio. And so even though Republicans control, I think, like two-thirds of the House, they're not getting the speaker they wanted. So you could imagine such a compromise, but it would take like sober-minded legislators, and that's not what we're seeing in the House right now. Which brings me to my question, which is like, how are they ever going to raise the debt ceiling? I mean, if between 5 and 20 hard right Republicans can stop their speaker from being elected, how is that caucus ever going to let the government function, do what it needs to do to enable the government to function?
The language surrounding describing this, I find insufficient to the task, because there are people who are just not interested in the project of anything other than their own project. And therefore, they're not even operating with the same sets of reason and exchange of ideas and argumentation that are required for the business of legislating, no matter what it is. And that's all on full display here. So, this is a sign of all the awfulness that's going to come on anything that's difficult. And McCarthy keeps giving away more and more of his power, including as of Thursday morning, there were reports that he's going to reduce the threshold on the motion to vacate the chair, which is essentially the ability of any member to raise a vote of no confidence on the speaker. And it was the threshold. McCarthy offered to lower it to 5 members raising a motion to vacate. Now it looks like it's going down to 1. But it means any piece of legislation, if somebody was bummed, they could raise the motion to vacate the chair, and then that would just waste a bunch of time.
But also, would that mean that any 5 Republicans plus all the Democrats could then expel him as Speaker? Like if
you could get to 218.
Yeah. So if all the Democrats decided to vote, or six. If 6 Republicans plus the Democrats, that's...
I guess they'd have to vote for a replacement. Or no, they could vacate the chair. No, and then, yeah, I think that's right.
Right, and then also, the minute you have a debt ceiling resolution, somebody raises a vote of no confidence and the speaker is gone. So right. I just, like, it just seems like it's hard to see. And Tucker Carlson is still on the side of the, I will call them rebels for the purpose of this sentence only, right? Which suggests that their larger goal of just getting attention, ending up being Fox News hosts or guests, like clearly Matt Gaetz, I mean, maybe Boehner too, that's what they're after. It's interesting, sort of, I guess, to watch Sean Hannity go after Lauren Boebert while Tucker Carlson remains on their side. I guess like that
you
little
sit and watch
scene battle.
Fox
no, I did
God,
watch
I didn't know
the
that.
For hours, David, for hours. No, but I did watch Hannity go after Boebert, which I thought was kind of interesting. Anyway, I bring up Fox just because I think so much what is driving this is the bid for attention on right-wing media.
One other thing I'd just like to add is we should. There was I think, a usefully symbolic split screen happening on Wednesday, where while the votes were taking place on the House floor, the president, Joe Biden, and Mitch McConnell were meeting in Kentucky to celebrate infrastructure spending on a bridge that connects Ohio to Kentucky. Sherrod Brown was also a part of the meeting, a liberal Democratic senator who is up in the next cycle, who Mitch McConnell really hopes will lose. But nevertheless, for the purposes of governing and getting things done, they were all there celebrating this bipartisan achievement. That was happening while at the same time, the all of the awfulness of hyper-partisanship was causing the House to lock up. So it was a nice kind of juxtaposition of the two different ways of doing things in Washington.
One of the points about Matt Gaetz and Jim Jordan. So Jim Jordan is actually voting for McCarthy, but Jim Jordan is a real far right conspiracist, danger to the Republic. Matt Gaetz, that, but also kind of creepy. That Matt Gaetz wants his own subcommittee on the armed services, on the House Armed Services. He wants that. Jim Jordan is going to get to chair the House Judiciary Committee and convene all kinds of nutty investigations of Hunter Biden and who knows who else. And so there are also going to be real consequences to these folks having positions of power beyond the fact that they're making spectacle now. They were going to continue to make spectacle for months to come. Slate Plus members get so much additional content for their lives, so many extra things to fill their days and nights up. Member exclusive episodes, segments from us, extra segments from us and other shows like Amicus and Hang Up and Listen. No ads on any podcasts, unlimited reading on the Slate site. You can become a member by going to slate.com/gabfestplus. Today, we're going to have a Slate Plus segment about football, whether you should watch football in the wake of the incredibly disturbing and tragic events at the game on Monday night. So we'll talk about that. Slate.com/GabFest Plus to become a member today. This episode of the GabFest is sponsored by Aura Frames. Are you ready to win Mother's Day? Cement your reputation as the best gift giver in your family? Give the moms in your life an Aura digital picture frame preloaded with decades of family photos. That mom will love looking back on childhood memories, seeing you what you're up to today, checking out grandkids, checking out cousins, and even better, with unlimited storage and an easy-to-use app, you can keep on updating your mom's frame with new photos so that it's the gift that keeps on giving. This is how I live in my family. I gave my mother an Aura frame. It was either for Mother's Day or for her birthday. She absolutely adores it. She's constantly hectoring me to update it with more photos, which I do. I also gave my girlfriend's mother an Aura frame, and I hope she hectors my girlfriend to update it with more photos. But it is a present that will bring absolute delight to a mother in your life. And they have a great deal for Mother's Day. GabFest listeners can save on this perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's AuraFrames.com. Use code GabFest at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply.
If you want to understand what is happening in the United States right now, you really need to understand what's happening with the courts, the law, and the Supreme Court. The battle between democracy and whatever this cage match is that we're witnessing, it's going to be won and lost at the ballot box, but it's also going to be won and lost in the courtrooms. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I host Slate's legal podcast, Amicus, and we are doubling our output, bringing you weekly episodes from here on in, because how else can we keep an eye on the many trials of Donald Trump, the conservative legal movement's assaults on our rights, the Supreme Court's latest slate of environmental gutting, gun safety eviscerating cases on the docket? So follow Amicus wherever you get your podcasts, new episodes dropping every Saturday morning.
George Santos is elected to Congress. He hasn't been sworn in, but he exists in a kind of, if everyone is in limbo, he's in a kind of limbo coupled with some other particular form of torture. I cannot remember anyone living the kind of disgrace that George Santos is living in. He is, of course, the Republican elected to Congress in New York, taking a fairly safe Democratic seat, or a seat that was certainly up for a tight election. And in order to win this seat, he posed as the descendant of Holocaust survivors, as an alumnus of Citibank and Goldman Sachs, I think, as the founder of a dog protecting charity. And he was elected. And after some brief digging following his election, the New York Times and now others have determined that Santos is a serial fabulist of the highest order, not Jewish, not a graduate of the college he claimed to have been a graduate of, or the high school he claimed to have gone to, never a Goldman Sachs employee, the dog charity, effectively non-existent. What there was a trail of debt, of lies, a criminal charge in Brazil, and an incredible open question, Emily, which is, how did Democrats botch the opposition research on this so completely? So obviously, you know, Santos is a kind of moral criminal, if not an actual criminal. He may be an actual criminal. He's lied. But there is a kind of basic due diligence that you would expect the opposition in a contentious House race to have done. And they seem to have completely botched it.
Well, they did some of it. There's this like really long Oppo document and it has some glimmers of it. They just didn't connect the dots and the press didn't either. And I think that part of probably why they fumbled this is that it's so unusual to have such a glaring trail of lies, right? In some ways, like the fact that he was a serial fabulist probably spared him because nobody would really think that you would do this much lying. So when you look at the Oppo doc in retrospect, it has like, yeah, we can't find this supposed charity registered anywhere. Or it seems like, you know, maybe he exaggerated some things on his resume. But the idea that it's all just lies through and through, missed them. And I think it's like, it reminds me of the Stephen Glass episode from The New Republic, where you had like just an inordinate amount of falsity going on. And it just like took a while for people to understand that that was even like possible.
Well, but The New Republic, no offense to The New Republic, it's like no one cares what's in some random left-wing magazine. This is a guy who's running for Congress in a year in a very rich district, in a district which is clearly close for a house that is going to be very close. Like, it appears that there's just
malpractice.
It's a malpractice. And also, I guess the second point, which is that it shows how weak local journalism is in this country, that there was no investigation of who this person is running for a House seat by local media that uncovered the black marks.
Although in
on
this
his
case,
resume.
Local media, I mean, this is a seat in Queens and Long Island. So local media is national media.
They
like,
good
not
have,
just
they
the
have
New York
good
Times.
Local media there. Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, the Times did break the story. It just obviously took until after the election. And that seems crazy, but it also seems, now that he is this huge story and it's so apparent that he falsified everything, it seems really obvious. And I mean, I think you're right. There was political malpractice here and maybe journalistic malpractice as well. On the other hand, you know, ex ante, like beforehand, we don't know that this is all going to add up into a giant story, right?
The North Shore Leader did actually report about Santos before the election took place. It's just that nobody paid attention to the questions they were raising about his resume.
Do you guys think that there are a lot of other people with significant fables and lies in their backgrounds who are serving in high elected office? I'm so naive that I assume that you can't get away with that. Like that you, in the age of Google, that you can't just be that brazen and inventing things about yourself. But clearly I am a simpleton.
Well, there are little things that people have, you know, Richard Blumenthal was a pretty big one when he talked about service, senator from Connecticut who talked about serving during the Vietnam War. But he never saw combat. So he I believe that was the, he misrepresented his military service. Let's put it that way. Marco Rubio's story about his Cuban parents wasn't, quite as he said, but those are kind of one-offs. But I think what is amazing with Santos is just the real comprehensive nature of the lies. I mean, it was really, it's surprising that he hasn't already declared himself Speaker of the House, given his inclination to claim titles that he doesn't deserve.
The Republicans are basically refusing to act against him. What could they do? I mean, he presumably will be exiled and ignored. He'll be forced to show up to cast votes for them, but he's not going to be, they're not going to like have parties for him. He's not going to get any good committee assignments, if any committee assignments.
What's funny is the Ethics Committee could do something, but the Republicans and their Rules Committee changes are likely to undermine completely the Ethics Committee. So that probably wouldn't happen. Even if he got a criminal conviction or was cited with a felony, that act on its own wouldn't disqualify him from holding office. So there would have to be a 2/3 vote in the House to remove him from office. Last time that happened was with James Traficant, of Ohio, who was removed from the House after he was convicted of felony racketeering. That would be what would have to happen. There would be I think, is the formal vote of 2/3 of the House. But if you're in the majority, you have to, the mechanism for bringing it to the floor, I think, would go through the majority. So if they don't want to bring it up, he gets to keep his seat.
The biggest legal threat seemed to be campaign finance violations, potentially. Just adding that to the mix.
Should it be a crime, Emily, to lie to voters about who you are and your record? Is it a crime, first of all?
I don't think it's a crime. I mean, right now we have this Supreme Court precedent that suggests that some lies have First Amendment free speech protections. I read that case pretty narrowly. It was about someone who lied about their military service. I think it's still possible. I mean, obviously, when you defame someone, that's a lie, right? You have to prove that it was false. It can't be merely false to be... to provide civil liability, but it has to be false, like, to start with. So, I mean, there are some lies that are actionable, and there's been some pretty interesting discussion in this whole avalanche of disinformation world that we live in. Should we make it easier to prosecute people for lying, especially about election-related matters? And so you could imagine a law that tried to make it a lie for people running for office, arguing that this is key to our democracy and it's one area in which we should have a stricter standard. But it would be very hard to enforce and to draw lines, right? I mean, people embellish and fluff and, you know, spin constantly. And so I think that's the tricky part.
And you can argue, as I have in a limited case, and maybe you have too, David, that the ability to lie, spin, and otherwise do some tailoring at the edges is crucial to lawmaking and politics. But could the real George Santos sue the fabulist George Santos? That might be the ultimate direction we're going here.
I mean, David started out by saying that Santos, like, seemed tortured, but he doesn't seem tortured to me. It seems like he's just going to take the obvious lesson from Donald Trump and whoever else, which is just like, you just keep going, right? And like, it's, you know, whatever.
Yeah, but I don't think he's going to be welcome. I don't think he's going to be welcome in the Republican conference. I don't think they want to be next to him. They'll take his vote when they need his vote, but they're not going to do press conferences with him. They're not going to let him sponsor legislation.
Fair enough. I think they'll just try to, like, keep him at arm's length. And then what will be interesting will be the next election. How much will the voters care about this? Because presumably he will be there. And I guess the question will be, will Republicans let him run for re-election?
No chance this guy is a more than a one-term member of Congress. I will bet any amount of money with any person in the world that this guy is not in Congress 2 years from now.
We'll see.
Any amount of money.
It's up to the Republican primary voters, right? Or, I mean, you're imagining that Santos won't run again. I feel like that's overconfident.
No, he'll run again. He will get primaried. And if he doesn't get primaried, he'll get beaten in a general election. You cannot pretend. The main thing he did is pretend to be Jewish. Like, I honestly think that's the one that's going to just come back. And
why?
Like, pretending to be Jewish. I don't know. It reflects a kind of emptiness of soul and character that is, I understand, and actually making up the dog charity too. Those two are the real problems. The pretending to have worked at Goldman Sachs and whatever, like, who hasn't pretended to work at Goldman Sachs? Holocaust survivors?
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, it's 2 years away. Maybe he'll do some great thing. He'll, like, you know, save someone, rescue someone from a burning building and turn into a hero.
We get the lawmakers we deserve.
Emily, what did the FDA and Justice Department do to make it somewhat easier to get hold of the drugs approved for medication abortions?
The federal government, the Biden administration, did two things. The first thing is that it is now possible for regular pharmacies to stock and supply the drugs for medication abortion. Up until now, you either had to get them from mail order pharmacy, that was a COVID era regulation, or from the office of a doctor who's certified to supply the medications, which are called mifepristone and misoprostol. Now you can just get it from your regular pharmacy. I should add that there are still hoops to jump through. The doctor, or in some states, nurse practitioner or midwife who can supply the medication still has to be specially certified, and the pharmacy also has to be certified. So this doesn't mean that, you know, every pharmacy is going to have these medications. It certainly is different from over-the-counter provision. That is not what the FDA did. But in blue states where it's perfectly legal to get this medication, it's going to be easier to get them. And the second thing, which is more legal and kind of a thicket of its own, but important, is that the Justice Department issued an opinion that's binding on the federal government that says that these old federal laws from the 1870s that literally taken appear to ban the shipping, mailing of any instrument, thing, drug used to procure an abortion, that those laws don't apply to misoprostol and mifepristone because the FDA has legalized them. In other words, this Justice Department opinion kind of goes back, looks at all the cases about these laws. They're called the Comstock laws. And says they've always been interpreted by the courts to be about unlawful instruments or drugs or whatever to provide an abortion. And so that's how we, the federal government, also interpret them. And so it's legal for the post office to accept mailings of them and also FedEx and everybody else who ships. And that's more of a big deal for providing the medications into states where there are state laws that prohibit them. The Justice Department is still recognizing those state laws, right? They're not saying no state can prosecute anyone shipping or receiving, but they're saying for purposes of federal law, these federal statutes can't be enforced.
So if John Dickerson, if he mailed mifepristone to a friend in Texas to help them with their abortion, the state prosecutors in Texas could charge John Dickerson with a crime, but federal prosecutors would not.
Yes, exactly. There could still be a state law that could apply. We haven't really seen that happen yet, but it could. And the Justice Department can't tell the state prosecutors they can't do that. But they can say there's no threat of federal enforcement. These laws haven't been enforced by the federal government for like a century. But to make that clear is important because, you know, companies, the post office, like everybody needs to know that up front. It's helpful for them to know that up front.
Have we seen, Emily, since Dobbs, any attempt to enforce laws against people in other states, any criminal charges from one state to another yet?
Not that I know of. I mean, this is a really interesting wrinkle. I, you know, wrote a big piece about the various legal threats in the Times Magazine in October. And one of the things that abortion opponents who follow this closely were saying to me at the time is that the midterm election was going to be important because part of the question of legal enforcement is a political one. Is there a political appetite for actually prosecuting abortion providers, prosecuting women and other people who receive the drugs? Like, that's a very aggressive stance. And I think the fact that the Republicans didn't do as well as they expected in the midterm has been a setback for that kind of enforcement. Obviously, it could still be on the table, right? I mean, all it takes is one prosecutor who has a case that they discover. So part of what I think is preventing this from happening so far is that it's not so easy to find such a case, right? And then you have to be able to prove various things, like that the person who sent it knew the drugs were going to be used for unlawful purposes, etc. So maybe that's why we haven't seen it so far, and it's still a possibility on the horizon.
John, do you think it would be likely that any Republican president would attempt to undo these federal measures that the Biden administration has rolled out? I mean, for example, would they try to compel the FDA to disapprove mifepristone, or would they sort of tell the Justice Department, now you're going to enforce the Comstock laws?
Emily, you can fix me on this, but I think this becomes like the Mexico City rule, where which was about funding organizations overseas, giving foreign aid to organizations that, in the view of Republican administrations, encouraged abortions overseas. Is that right, Emily? Is that what Mexico City did?
Yeah, gag order.
So what you had was, when Democrats came into office, they reinstated the ability to give funds to such organizations, and when Republicans were president, they undid them. And so I would expect this to bounce the same way. It would be something that a Republican candidate would talk about in the primaries and probably not go on about too much in the general, given the way abortion politics played out in the last midterm election.
That's certainly possible. So I think there are some regulations involving the drugs, let's call them, they often get called MIFI and MISO for short, that a Republican administration would try to unwind. I mean, they'd still have to go through the whole notice and comment process. You can't just like wave a magic wand. However, making them full stop disapproved, like saying that nobody in the country can have these medications anymore, that would be a very big step to take, because it would be flying in the face of what blue states have made legal. And so I feel like even, you know, a very assertive Republican president might think twice before doing something that dramatic. We'll see.
Let's think that through, because it would be an interesting question to surface in the course of a campaign, because you would imagine that that those who are against abortion rights would want to vote for a candidate who would do this, who would do anything they could from the federal level to restrict abortion wherever it took place. And then, as a political matter, we would have to look at the battleground states where it would matter, right? So it doesn't matter if it's a blue state, because the blue states are going to vote for the Democrats. So what purplish state would move by a president hurt women who sought abortion rights, and then we'd have our answer about whether they would talk about it.
But I think the process of literally unapproving an FDA-approved drug would require so much monkeying with the mechanisms of the FDA, with how the FDA works, that it would probably be. I mean, that would be. I can't think of an example where there's been a political move to take a medicine that's been approved and literally disapprove it for political reasons.
Yeah. I mean, also remember, these drugs have been approved since the early 2000s. So we're not talking about the basic approval being a new Biden administration move at all. I mean, I think you're totally right, though, John, about the strategy, or whatever you want to call it, in the presidential primaries. And I guess the lesson I see in all of this politically, and I'm hearing this loud and clear from groups that oppose abortion, the presidency is going to matter to abortion access in the United States directly in a way that it hasn't before. Or it sort of did, but people didn't notice it. And now this question of abortion medication, which a lot of Americans still don't really know what it is, or that you can have an abortion by taking pills. I think by the next presidential set of primaries, that's going to be much more familiar. And the idea that the president has a lot of direct power over providing this method of abortion, as well as appointing judges, which we're super familiar with, that's going to be front and center, and it's going to play out in the Republican primaries.
To that point, Emily, what do we know about what's happened with medication abortion since Dobbs? And in particular, in states where abortion is illegal, do we know whether there is a lot of mailing of drugs or access to drugs in those states?
Yeah, there are thousands of pills being mailed into those states. We know that from a group called Aid Access, which I wrote about in October. The leader of that group, Rebecca Gompertz, is a physician in the Netherlands. And so she has been so far outside of the jurisdiction of any state that would try to prevent her from mailing the drugs. And they also come in through all kinds of other companies that are on the internet. Like, if you Google the drugs, you can order them. And there's some risk in getting them through the mail, but lots and lots of people in red states have been taking them. And trying to cut off that flow. If you really oppose abortion, that would be a huge priority for you because it's the way in which a lot of people are accessing abortion in the first trimester, along with traveling out of the state. So far, we have not seen a state really make a big move to try to cut off that supply.
Let's go to cocktail chatter. When you, John Dickerson, are high on a cocktail of serious painkillers plus a crystalline martini, what are you going to be chattering about?
The painkillers I'm taking are, I don't think I want to mix them with a martini. Anyway, my cocktail chatter is about a book called Winesburg, Ohio, which is by Sherwood Anderson. Have you read it?
Many, many, many years ago.
Yeah, I had never, not only had I never read it, I'd never even heard of it. And it was a, I stayed in a hotel in Chicago, and it was one of the books they leave in the room, just sort of, you know, should you have the free time. It's a very slim volume. I don't quite know exactly what I think of it because it's, I love it, but I don't know whether I love it because I love this, it's the internal stories of these highly idiosyncratic residents of this town at the beginning of the 20th century, sort of 1915-ish or so. And these super internal fraught internally fraught people. But it's also a real window into kind of what, or this is what I imagine anyway, what life in a, kind of the lonely life of certain kinds of people would have been like in a world before we were all connected in the way we are now, which causes its own kind of loneliness, to be sure. But this is a kind of portrait of loneliness in that time period that I found really affecting. So it's a quick read for anybody who's looking for a tightly drawn, slightly spooky in weird ways, picture of American life at the beginning of the 20th century in a very small town in Ohio.
The book that I associate with it in my mind, which I read recently, is Olive Kittredge, which is about sort of, it's again, a linked series of stories about people in a small town in Maine. And also kind of depressing, really revealing, really human. That's a good throwback there, John. What's your chatter, Emily?
My chatter, I'm going to do a double chatter because this is the time of the year where I catch up on all the 2022 cultural offerings that I missed. So bear with me, listeners. I wanted to recommend a book called The Furrows by Namwali Sirpel, which I was sort of avoiding because it's about a difficult subject. A child dies like on the first page, but it's really riveting. I'm about halfway through. Totally worth reading. It's called The Furrows again. And then I finally saw the movie Tar, which I was fascinated by. It has all kinds of like flaws and wrinkles, but I was really interested in it. And my excuse for chattering about that are some relatively new pieces of some relatively new essays about it. So Zadie Smith just published an essay about the movie in the New York Review of Books, which I thought was great. Amanda Hess has an essay about Tar and also the new movie Women Talking in the New York Times. And Dan Coyce wrote a piece for Slate with this interesting theory about how maybe the movie kind of turns into like a gothic nightmare horror story part of the way through, which I also thought was really interesting. So go consume all of that culture.
My chatter, also a kind of melange. First of all, honestly, all I'm thinking about, because I'm sitting here, is my poor cat is dying. And she's sitting next to me, and she's dying.
Oh, no.
And she's just been my boon companion for years, and I'm probably going to cry as I talk about it. But it's just making me really sad. Okay, my real chatters. First of all, I'm going to Scotland with my kids in the summer, and I would love some recommendations of places to stay, places to go, an awesome tour, a castle that you own that you would like to loan me, an amazing hotel to stay at, a great hike. Just email me, davidplotz@gmail.com. I would love that. Thank you. My real chatter is about something my daughter was telling me about, which is amazing, which I learned about, called gastrodiplomacy. And it's based on the observation, it's like, gosh, aren't there a lot of Thai restaurants, even though you or at least I never meet any Thai people. Like, I don't know any Thai immigrants to the United States, but there sure seem to be a lot of Thai restaurants. And it turns out that Thailand is one of several countries that practices something which is called gastro diplomacy or culinary diplomacy. And in the case of Thailand, it has been an active effort to fund the growth of Thai restaurants all around the world. And so they make loans to people who want to start restaurants, and they help them set up the restaurants. They give them specs for the restaurants. And even more interestingly, they have standardized dishes. So they want, if you're going to have a particular dish somewhere, they want you, and then you go to a Thai restaurant somewhere else, they want that dish to be similar or the same when you have it somewhere else and spelled the same. And so this is a very conscious effort on the part of the Thai government. Anyway, this is a kind of diplomacy. It's also practiced by Taiwan, by Singapore. I think there, my daughter said, although I couldn't find this, that Korea has done this to standardize the spelling of kimchi so that when you see the word kimchi, it's spelled the same way. And so that people know, oh, it's the same thing. I'm getting it. But I love this idea. The easiest way to win hearts and minds is through the stomach, as the Wikipedia page says. Listeners, you have sent us chatters, and we have an amazing listener chatter this week. Not so much because the chatter is itself amazing, although it's very good, but because it has a great story behind it. So you email them to us at gabfest@slate.com. You tweet them to us at @slategabfest. This week comes from Nathan Camps, who sent us a chatter. And then when we followed up to ask him to do it on the air, he noted that since he emailed it to us a couple of days ago, he has become a father. And his daughter, Alexandra Marie Camps, was born about 8 hours after he originally emailed us. So mazel tov to Nathan and Alexandra and all the other Camps.
Hey, GabFest. It's Nathan Camps here from Los Angeles. My cocktail chatter this week is about the mountain lion named P22, who lived in Griffith Park for the last 10 years until his recent passing, and a Rolling Stone article in remembrance of him titled A Celebrity in a Land of Celebrities. P22 was born in the Santa Monica Mountains, successfully crossed two of LA's busiest freeways to reach Griffith Park, and rose to fame in 2013 after National Geographic published an incredible photograph of him underneath the Hollywood sign. His story was emblematic of the impact of urban sprawl on the mountain lion population of Southern California, and part of his legacy will be the Wallace Annenberg Wildlife Crossing, which broke ground this spring. It will be the largest wildlife crossing in the world and will be instrumental in the conservation of mountain lions, who frequently are struck and killed on highways while attempting to make the same journey P22 did. Though I never saw him, there was always something exciting about visiting Griffith Park and knowing P22 was there, somewhere. And I particularly liked a quote from Beth Pratt of the National Wildlife Federation, who said that even in the city which we thought wildness had been banished from a long time ago, he reminded us it's still here. Rest in peace, P22. We all miss you.
That is our show for today. The GabFest is produced by Shayna Roth. Our researcher is Bridget Dunlap. Our theme music is by They Might Be Giants. Ben Richmond is Senior Director for Podcast Operations, and Alicia Montgomery is VP of Audio for Slate. Please follow us on Twitter at @SlateGabFest and tweet chatter to us there or email it to us at gabfest@slate.com. For Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, I'm David Plotz. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week and wishing John a healthier back in weeks to come. Hello, Slate Plus. How are you? I turned on the TV on Monday night. I'm an avid watcher of football, and I turned it on literally to the play that stopped the game in Cincinnati, the game between the Bills and the Bengals, where Damar Hamlin, a safety on the Bills, collapsed and had to be resuscitated on the field. Hamlin, as we tape, remains in critical condition in a hospital in Cincinnati, I believe. And it's it was among the most disturbing things I've ever seen, certainly while watching sports, but even while watching television, just to see a man become that close to death, go that close to death, playing a sport, which is a sport of such tremendous brutality and violence, was horrifying. So we want to talk about whether football is a sport that we should watch. Do you guys watch football?
Not really. I mean, a little bit. I don't have some, like, I don't watch football, but I don't really care about football. So for me, this conversation, it would be much easier to say this is a gladiator sport. We're watching people crash into each other with the force of, you know, so much strength and muscle and weight. And it's like crashing into a brick wall, and we should stop.
I don't watch it. I used to be an avid Washington Redskins fan when they were called the Redskins, having grown up there and gone to the games every Sunday. Playing football was a huge, huge part of my life. I mean, an important turning point because of its, I don't know if brutality is the word, but because it...
That was just a snippet from our Slate Plus conversation. If you want to hear the whole conversation, go to slate.com/gabfestplus to become a member today.